favorite guy on tenor sax, Stanley Turrentine, with Too Blue. That's from his 1973 album, Don't Mess With Mr. T. And he meant it then, and I mean it today. Just don't mess with him. He's one of my favorites. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Thursday, October the 23rd. How fast this month is moving. And a couple of things before we get into the program proper. Saturday. On Saturday, I'll be talking here. Gary just mentioned that. I'll be talking here at PRN. By reservation, you have to reserve because seating is extremely limited. 646-926-5422. Please call and reserve your seat. 646-926-5422. I've been doing a number of talks around the city, and tonight, this evening, I'm talking in Newark at REFAL headquarters. That's at 269-271 South 9th Street in Newark. I'll be talking in all these different speeches I'm making, really challenging people to wake up and get involved and really deal with the reality that we are living in and that is so foreboding. And if we leave things alone to progress on their own course, we're done for. So on Saturday, I'll be talking to the progressive community about, you know, falling down on the job. What will it take for the community to wake up and become involved in a more proactive and more pronounced way and to really take a look at what might have happened? But we don't want to dwell in the past. It doesn't really get us anywhere. But it is important to reflect a bit on it because it gives us information about how we can correct for future action. And future action is needed because more and more the politics of the day, the sociology of the day, the economy of the day, these things are driving wedges between and among people. And people are crawling back into their safety zones, and that's not good. So I'll be talking about that on Saturday, specifically addressing the progressive community about where it has gone, where has all its energy gone, and what is causing it to become bunkerized. It's just, you know, living in a kind of bubble. And how do you get more and more engaged in across-the-board struggle, which is really what progressivism is all about. It's about seeing the big picture. Tonight I'm talking at REFAL headquarters in Newark about reclaiming, rebuilding, and rebounding in communities that have been targeted for annihilation, and not just the physical sense, but also in terms of family, in terms of, you know, what's going on, the human fabric that used to hold communities together, what has happened to it, and how to basically repair it in order to secure a better future. Well, I come to the topic today, which is a follow-up of the topic yesterday, and we talked about Ferguson, and I'm talking about it because some interesting things have happened since we last spoke. Several major newspapers and at least CNN in the television realm have been plying the same kind of story. And it's not accidental at all. A story about the killing of Michael Brown, age 18, on August the 9th in Ferguson, Missouri, by police officer Darren Wilson, and the grand jury proceeding that was supposed to determine, or is supposed to be determining, since it's allegedly ongoing, the outcome of this initial phase of investigation, which is whether charges should be filed against a police officer, and if so, what charges. All of the stories that have appeared so far in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the New York Times, these are big-time papers. And they frame, in many ways, the national attitude about things. And interestingly, they all kind of are reporting the same kinds of facts, the same angle to the story. And this is not unusual, because we've seen this many times before, but it is disturbing. In fact, none other than the State Department of, not the State Department, the U.S. Department of Justice has issued a statement saying that they find it very troubling. They are concerned about these leaks. The stories are mostly predicated on leaks and on official sources that are not identified, and sources close to the investigation, these kinds of amorphous descriptions and so forth. And I want to talk about what is really at issue in this story and why it is that it is in many ways a continuum of what this community, the African-American community in the United States, has been dealing with literally for decades, if not centuries. The story really isn't so much about the function of the grand jury, and CNN's legal analyst, who used to be a former homicide prosecutor, a man by the name of Paul Callan, wrote a piece that was posted on CNN's site in praise of the hallowed, he called it, the hallowed institution, and he's referring to the grand jury. And why is he writing this? He says, quote, and I quote, they're not even hiding it anymore, it is, quote, for those who believe that the grand jury procedure is some sort of cop and prosecutor conspiracy to trample the rights of minority citizens, unquote. So here we have the articulated intention based on an articulated recognition that race has a great deal to do with this, and it does. I'm going to parallel another case that would seem completely unrelated to this case, and it's the Tawana Brawley case. I come back to this case time and again because it is the central question here. It is the question in Ferguson. It is the question, it was the question in Newburgh, New York, with Tawana Brawley. It is the question in most every single high-profile case that I've ever covered. It is the same question. I'll tell you what that question is in a moment. First, we have, let's take a look at where the situation is objectively with this case. Okay. The case has gone to a grand jury. We discussed here that that motion itself was questionable, and it was, in my view, a telling flaw in the legal representation of the family's interests. This grand jury was constituted quite hurriedly, and without objection from the family's attorney. And family's attorneys, because it's more than one, and without objection from the family's main representative, Al Sharpton. The environment is hostile. The environment is racist. These things have been documented. There is brazen conflict of interest here. The prosecutor who would be presenting this case, his own father, had been murdered by an African-American man. His father was a police officer. there are reasons to believe that, and he has in his history of prosecuting cases locally, there have been many questions about his attitudes toward prosecutions of people of color. There are many, many questions here that should have informed some form of litigation, some form of legal protest about this case going to a local prosecutor as opposed to a special prosecutor. We've talked about this in great detail, so let's start there. So the case does not go to a special prosecutor, but we don't know what kind of jury this is. But we do know that the media all seem to have had access to the jury at this critical time. So it suggests something was acting in concert. Somebody is giving out information at a particular time in anticipation of a soon-to-be-announced conclusion of the grand jury's term, and therefore a decision by the grand jury. My reading is, and it was from the very beginning, I predicted it, that I may be wrong, and I'm hoping that I'm wrong, but it has happened so often, it is almost a textbook case for people who have been covering these kinds of cases. For other people, this is like, you know, the first time they've encountered this kind of stuff. But there are those of us who have a strong history of covering these kinds of cases, and we can pretty much tell you how it would go. The media had taken a collective position, you can call it, and this is not by chance. They're in concert with each other. The timing suggests that they all agree this is the time to write such stories, or they were approached by these so-called official people and people in the know and people close to the case or whoever it is, these amorphous unnamed entities that are feeding them information, apparently fed them all the information at the same time. So they're reporting it all at the same time. And the thrust of their stories, and this is consistent throughout all of their stories, the thrust of their stories is Michael Brown caused his own death. He basically engaged in a struggle, a physical attack upon the officer, and the officer consequently feared for his life because, among other things, Michael Brown was reaching for his sidearm, and so he feared for his life. He feared he was in imminent danger of losing his life, and so he fired and killed Michael Brown. There are all kinds of stories now about people are now talking about the fine details. Was Michael Brown in the car at the time the shots were fired? Was he outside of the car? How far away from the officer was he? Some people are saying, well, he was about 35 feet, or was he 100 feet? And they're arguing the minutiae of this case as if they, and in fact they are, trying the case outside of a courtroom, because now everybody's an authority, having been furnished with, quote, official information, and unable independently to corroborate any of it, but they're reporting it as official information. This is classic. This is classic in cases where you have this racial element. You have a white officer and a black kid, and you have the community erupting over this permanent impediment in their communities. The abuse of authority and abuse of excessive force by police officers on citizens, causing in many cases their deaths. We've talked about that. But the media had decided, at least these major media outlets I've just discussed with you, and some smaller ones, they're all basically mimicking and mirroring the thrust of the major news outlets. And so it is to condition us, the public, because all these things, these are authoritative news sources, right? They're newspapers and news outlets that have some degree of credibility, and they therefore report with credibility. This is the assumption. So the people would likely believe that what they are saying is true, and it is the, quote, other side of the story, unquote. When it isn't. It isn't even the side of the story. It is simply people's opinions being relayed to newspapers, and they decide, well, hey, this is a great coup. We can scoop our competition and write a story, and then it becomes fact. But none of it is fact. The real story here, the real issue here, however the grand jury votes, the real issue is, as it was in the Tawana Brawley case, that there is such an extraordinary effort being expended by the system to prevent this case from coming to trial. That's the story. People will argue, well, how far was he from this? And these things are not important, really, because at trial, these things can easily be established and easily argued and easily presented. And people will have an opportunity to decide which is the more credible argument. But the point of all of this choreography is to prevent the case from coming to trial at all. The similar position was taken in the Brawley case and in all these other high-profile cases is to prevent the case from coming to trial for all kinds of reasons. In the Ferguson case, what is the incentive for preventing this case from coming to trial? Well, we have the racial issue here. We have a history of abuse on the part of police force, and we have this young man. We have that dynamic being a very explosive dynamic in the United States. We have the authority that the police officer represents. Authority is to be protected. Authority is to be reinforced. And African Americans and people of color generally have no real rights. This is a huge part of this case. We have no real rights. That was a U.S. Supreme Court decision. The black man has no rights that the white man is bound to respect. That's a direct quote from the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Justice Roger B. Taney writing the majority opinion in 1857. And to this day, the attitudes have filtered down with that particular sensibility intact. The real issue in this case is not whether the police officer did something wrong or did something right, because at trial, that would be resolved and decided by a jury. And that's supposed to be the cornerstone of American jurisprudence, that everybody is entitled to a fair trial. In this case, the police officer, Darren Wilson, is entitled to a fair trial, and his victim is also entitled to a fair trial. But you see, they'd never tell you that. They will say, well, it's about the police officer and whether he should go on trial. No, it is also about the state. The state is the stand-in for the victim, allegedly. The state is to affirm the rights of the victim. The state is to take action in the interest, not just of the victim, but of the law. And the law says a person may not kill another person. That's the law across the board. But then we have all these qualifiers that enter the game here. Well, he's a police officer, so he's not a real ordinary person. This is a special circumstance. Was he acting in an official capacity when this happened? And was he, therefore, within departmental guidelines? They built all kinds of things around it, except they will not allow this case to come to trial. If this case were to come to trial, the risk is that, in fact, the police officer, with all of that symbology surrounding him as a stand-in for the authority of the state, as a white man, basically exercising the rights, the natural rights of white men in this country over black men, the symbology of the long-held relationships in Ferguson, where blacks need to know their place and whites are in charge. You know, they're talking about the grand jury, and it is reflected. In this grand jury of 12 local citizens, 9 of them are white. Only 3 are black. So you see how these things kind of filter down. But the intent is to prevent the case from coming to trial, which was, in fact, I have explained this just recently to someone asking me about the Tawana Brawley case. Well, was she lying or was she not lying? I said that was the easiest part of the case. The easiest part of the case to prove whether she was lying or not. Put the case in the court before a jury, which she was entitled to. She was entitled, and she was fighting. This is the whole point of this Brawley case. She was fighting. Her lawyers were fighting to bring the case to trial. The system was doing the exact opposite, fighting like crazy, breaking all kinds of laws, doing all kinds of underhanded and illegal things, including getting the state legislature to bar her attorney from entering a courtroom. This has never been done in the United States. An attorney who had a spotless record, no client of his had ever complained against him. This is Alton Maddox. He'd never had any run-ins with any ethical issues, nothing. And this, none other than the state attorney general did this and got away with it. Misused the grand jury to issue a report that none of the grand jurors even knew that they were supposed to be writing, never saw the report, and did not agree with the report that said Tawana Brawley committed a hoax. What was the significance of that trial? Had that gone to trial? Had that case gone to trial, the Brawley case, you would have had the first instance in the United States of a black woman basically winning a case on the basis of rape against her by white men. It was never supposed to happen. It would never happen. And so that case was not to come to trial. And in both cases now, although they are completely different, it would seem, in terms of the circumstances of the cases, they have this thing in common. And that is, in the end, the question to be posed is that it has been decided, it still is the case, that the system does not recognize the rights of African Americans to basic civil, not just civil, to protection of the law. Michael Brown, a victim of a homicide, this is determined not by the people, this is determined by the officials of the county. The medical examiner says this is a homicide. The law says when a homicide occurs, there are supposed to be inquiries and then a trial. But they will not allow a trial. And that's the whole story here. whether the police officer was acting within departmental guidelines or whether he was just a scared man or whatever it was that caused him to pull that trigger six times and shoot that young man six times. All of these things are supposed to be determined at trial. Put the case on trial. Let a jury of his peers listen to the evidence. And like in any other case, if it were reversed, it would have gone to trial. If Tawana Brawley, and here's the flip side of the Tawana Brawley case. Tawana Brawley was a 15-year-old girl in 1987, going on to 88 in the holiday season. And she told a story about being kidnapped off the street from being dropped off by the bus on the main road, and she's walking to her home on the side road. And she's taken into a car and for 4 days held hostage, held captive, and given some kind of a drug in the form of a drink, a milky-looking drink that kept her completely out of it. And during that time, she's raped repeatedly over the 4 days. When she's discovered, she is completely unresponsive to pain stimuli, to smelling salts, to voice, to touch, to anything. She is discovered with feces smeared all over her body, racial epithets scrawled on her torso, clumps of hair torn out of her head, and cyanotic, that is, she was turning blue. Her veins had collapsed. They could not administer even an IV because it kept bleeding into the muscle tissue. Her clothing was burnt. And the suggestion from the beginning was this was basically all part of a sex-crazed weekend, that she ran away from home and basically was trying to cover up this party, this nonstop party she was having with her friends over the weekend. And basically she kind of got what she signed up for. The case, they went through all this stuff to just prevent the case from coming to trial. And that has been her only demand. The demand has been, I want this case tried. If I'm lying, people will know. It's not difficult to prove. It's not a big deal, really, when you have a trial. You have a thing called evidence. And people will be able to determine on the basis of the evidence whether she's lying or not lying. But that was not the intent. The intent was that it should never come to trial. This is really at the root of what's going on in Ferguson. This case, from the very beginning, was determined that it should not come to trial. Similarly, the Eric Garner case, the chokehold case in Staten Island, the case from the very beginning, and you know, you automatically know this, the case is not supposed to come to trial. So it will be sidelined. All kinds of things will be made up. The media will do its part, its prearranged part. It will be fed whatever it is it needs to participate as the co-counsel in this case of saying, well, yeah, we agree. This man kind of, you know, if he had been less belligerent, he wouldn't be dead. And so he pretty much precipitated his own death by resisting arrest. We've seen this case, these kinds of cases, many, many times. And so this is why I say to you, when you're hearing more and more about the, quote, officer's side of the story, I'm sure it's important. But I would prefer the officer's side of the story be told not by amorphous, unnamed sources, I would like the officer's side of the story to be told in a court of law. Let the officer do the best he can to defend himself. He's entitled to that. And that's what a trial is for. You tell your story before a jury that represents the community, and they determine whether you are telling the truth or not. They determine the outcome of the case. They're not to be sidelined. They are the active participants, and they are, in fact, the jury. But look what has happened here. The prosecutor has decided, I'm going to call a grand jury. Boom, there it is. The lawyers, of course, I fault them for the fact that they have not yet legally registered any disagreement with anything so far. It's pitiful, but that's where it is. But that just does not excuse the fact that the state is proceeding in a rather conspiratorial way, I would say, and in a rather predictable way, because these kinds of cases follow a predictable path. They're not that clever to completely cover their tracks. They're not that good as lawyers either. So they use their authority in such a way to basically create a brand new case within the case. And the case simply is, a police officer killed a young man, and it has been ruled a homicide. The officer has admitted he is the agent of that homicide. The case should take a predictable path. It isn't. In the Brawley case, a young woman comes forward and says, "This is what has happened to me. Among my attackers was a prosecutor, a sitting prosecutor in Dutchess County, the son of a very influential Democratic Party operative. Another was a part-time cop. They were all white men." In the Central Park case, where the victim of a brutal, horrible attack that almost left her dead was unable to communicate at all. But the system went ahead and snatched up some suspects and made them defendants and made them go to jail, even though they had nothing to do with it. But the system worked predictably to deliver, quote, justice, unquote. This is the central question in all of these high-profile cases. The insistence that people of color are to experience an entirely different kind of jurisprudence. They're not entitled to the same kind of judicial outcome as the rest of society. A different treatment is reserved for them. And we have the media here stepping in to legitimize it, to say, they're making the case now, they're arguing the case right now. They're telling you, well, these are the facts. They have no reason to state these things as facts, but they state them as facts. And they get the sign off from their editors and their publishers and whoever else makes decisions as to what constitutes a news story. They seem not at all obligated to verify the facts or present at least a counter to whatever it is they're reporting from official sources. The thing is, they have a job to do, and their job is to prime the pump, to get the public to understand and accept what is to come. And what is to come is no justice. What is to come is that the police officer will simply be allowed to go away from this crime, and it will be ruled, he acted within departmental guidelines. so that this would essentially be reduced from a homicide case to an administrative determination. Meanwhile, a young 18-year-old man is dead. So what is this problem? Why do we see this occurring time and again? And it has to do with, again, the perception that in this racist apartheid society, that the law, like most any other institution, is not for everybody, not equally for everybody. In the same way that in some communities you have policing, where a police officer would tell little Johnny, you know, Johnny, you shouldn't be doing that. And if he catches Johnny doing the same thing 3 and 4 times, he will walk with Johnny and, you know, knock on Johnny's parents' home and door and say, you know, you need to take a look at this and correct little Johnny here, because he's treading down a wrong path, and this is the third time I've caught him, and you ought to do something. That's policing. In other communities, it's law enforcement. We have this duality all the time in the United States to deal with, and people don't realize it. That it actually, this is why I call racism the permanent flaw in the fabric of American life. You can't get away from it. Every single aspect of life. But here, it is blatant. It is screaming at you. It is unapologetic. And it is absolutely resolute about the idea that it will enforce the standing order that there will be no one system of justice. And Michael Brown does not deserve justice. The police officer does. The Tawana Brawley does not deserve justice. Her attackers do. And it's all on the basis of race and the perception of value associated with race. The people of dark hue have little or no value in the society. The system is not for them. The system is designed to contain them, to oppress them, to make sure they do not have a fair shake. They could never be right. There could never be an expectation of justice. And they will do everything now in the open. They used to cover these things up. But now it's right there in your face. They are so sure that all other systems will agree that this is the way it ought to go. So they have nothing to fear. We have in New York City with the Eric Garner case, we have the other phenomenon of a district attorney who decides, well, he's just going to be a special grand jury, as if people don't know what that's supposed to be. You can't just be a special grand jury. You just can't fashion a special grand jury. There are legal procedures about that. And this grand jury has been meeting, and we don't know what the outcome is, but we know that it won't probably be announced until after the election. Because, of course, the prosecutor is up for re-election. And these are the things that should send signals to people, especially those who insist on voting and endorsing these systems that oppress, endorsing these systems that continue to practice apartheid policies in the United States in this day and age. They insist on clinging to that slave past, where some people have rights and all the rights, and others have none. This writer for CNN, who did his treatise on the hallowed institution of the grand jury, you can't help but say to you, this guy, he lives in a bubble, has been living in that bubble for a long time. The bubble that says, I am a member of the empowered group, the group in power. And all of his references are about Henry VIII and Europe. Yeah. Basically, a deliberate detachment from life and reality in this country. They make up a whole different reality other than the one that actually exists. So he's going to talk, and he's talking about the grand jury, this hallowed institution, as if, you know, he's quoting, you know, the forefathers and all these other people, completely oblivious to the fact that he's actually telling the story of the origin of this duality here. One set of laws for whites, the other set for blacks and other people of color. He's telling the story, but absolutely denying it at the same time. This is where we are. And this is why I come to the point of saying there has to be, well, there doesn't have to be, there ought to be, in the progressive community, especially at the political level, and it is disturbing that in this particular case in Ferguson, which is loaded with symbology and with significance, that these voices are not being heard because they are not saying anything. They're concerned about militarization of police. Well, geez, you know, black people have been living with militarized police forever. But they're not discussing what they're seeing. And they're seeing a duality in the legal system. They're seeing the misapplication of the law. They're seeing the abrogation of officials who should be functioning in a different capacity altogether to ensure the fair application of the law. But they're saying nothing. And they prefer to see this as a case of, well, the cop killed this young man and it's just too much. It's just way over the edge. But it's more than that. It is the continuing story of oppression in the United States. And there are thousands of cases like this. Thousands. Tens of thousands of cases like this. So I want you to, when you get more news, because there'll be more in advance of this announcement, which should come, they say, within a couple of weeks, early November, when the jury's term officially, the second extension of this jury, would have ended, the priming of the pump to create the alternative narrative here and to divert attention from what the story really is. In Ferguson, it's a very simple story, really, and very difficult. The simple story is this case should be a trial. But the victim in this case is of a group of people who long ago were determined to have no rights and who only recently were grudgingly given some civil rights, but they have no natural rights. In the Ferguson case, it is the police officer who has natural rights and the victim who's civil rights might have been violated. See? That's the continuing story of America. The victim is the one who caused the trouble and got his just deserts. The police officer, the very representation of the narrative of America, of white supremacy, of authority over the miscreants, he must be vindicated at all costs. As a white man in this country, as a symbol of power and authority, and as a representative of a system. See, that's the narrative, and that's the story here. And that's why this case went down this path. That's why the Eric Garner case is going down its path. That's why the Tawana Brawley case was absolutely corrupted. There were so many laws broken in that case. And in broad daylight, they didn't even have the consideration that maybe they'd be found out. They didn't care, because the entire system worked hand in glove with each other to produce the predictable result. There was no way a little black girl was going to prevail against 4 to 6 white men over a charge of rape. It would never happen in this country. So, that's the story of Ferguson, and that's the story of the Michael Brown case, and that's the story of the media doing these kinds of reports to prime the pump and to get everybody pretty much in order, to get you in your appropriate psychological space to accept what is to come. And what is to come is no justice. None at all. And this is an unfortunate side comment, too, about the need for lawyers who take their jobs seriously. The unfortunate thing in the Michael Brown case is that the lawyers simply have not been on the job. They're not paying attention. They are lax in being proactive about this case. They basically are standing by and letting the system do whatever it wants to do. They have exercised very little, if any, initiative to even register that they have questions and that they are looking out for the interests, not just of Michael Brown, but in the interest of justice. They're taking the same position in the Eric Garner case. They're doing nothing except waiting for the moment to begin negotiations across the table with the same system as to what the value of the life of Michael Brown might be in millions of dollars and what the value of the life of Eric Garner might be in millions of dollars. And they will come to terms and they will settle. So for them, it's a matter of just waiting and negotiating the value of the deaths of these two men. There will be no justice at their initiative. They're not taking any initiative at all in terms of securing justice here. Or in any of the other cases that they've been involved in. We had the Trayvon Martin case. The same lawyers were handling that. And there is yet to be a piece of paper filed that says they objected to the prosecutor or they objected to the jury, the makeup of the jury, or they objected to the judge's instructions to the jury, or they objected to the prosecutor, or they objected to the way the case was being had. There's nothing to say that they had problems with the administration of, quote, justice, unquote, in that case. And look what happened. And in the aftermath of Trayvon Martin case, there is no legal precedent set in that case with respect to stand your ground. So we now have across the country several stand your ground cases in which African Americans are the targets of prosecution. So we have that internal problem to deal with, and that is to say to those in the community who are in a position to create these changes and to shore up the rights of people, not just their clients specifically, but their whole community. They have fallen down on the job in the most embarrassing way, and there's no excuse for it, other than it would suggest that they're in it for the money, period. And they do not intend to spend evenings burning the midnight oil in anybody's law library looking for case law and looking to put lawsuits together to challenge anything. They're not interested in confronting the system at all. They're just interested in the eventual handsome payout. What an indictment. What a sad, sad commentary. What an atrocity. And they ought to be called out on it. Well, I just wanted to plant this in your head because these cases, I've covered so many of these kinds of cases. I've already laid out to you what I know, what from my experience, what would be the course of action. And we will see whether, it, in fact, these cases follow that course of action, that predictable course of action, which is to refuse to grant victims their rights, which is to say the refusal to recognize the natural rights of African Americans and the insistence on maintaining a white supremacist system. We'll see. If it's to change, it will change because there would be huge legal battles. That's the fight. You need some really sharp people. It's so sad that you don't have... What we need is 100 Alton Maddoxes. Just set them loose in this country. And see what they will do. Because this is the fight. The law is used in a very, very oppressive way. And it has to stop. And the only way we could stop it is with competent lawyers who know what they're doing, who specialize in this kind of litigation, and who can stop them cold in the court of law, use their own laws against them, and to deliver justice. If we are interested in justice, it's the only way to go. Have that fight in court. And the people should be asking the question, don't tell me who is guilty and who is innocent. Let the process take place. Bring this case to trial. We'll all know who is innocent and who is guilty. We'll all know who is lying and who is not. I want to thank you for joining me today, and I thank you for joining me every day. Again, this evening at REFAL headquarters at 269-271 South 9th Street in Newark. I'll be there at 6 o'clock sharp. And on Saturday, if you'd like to attend a session of, you know, some pretty open talk here. We're not going to be shy. We're going to be open and mature in our conversation with each other on Saturday. Please reserve your seat. It's limited seating. 646-926-5422. And it would be my last talk before I go back to that former slave state in the South. So thank you so much for being with me today. I hope this opened your eyes a little bit or caused you to rethink things and at least prepares you for the onslaught, because it's going to happen. And a pleasure always, and a great, great, great privilege to be in your company.